Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. We'll be speaking to our PG shortly, and also our guest speaker for the first Saturday of every month is Phil Muffett. The fact that it's Easter bank holiday weekend hasn't put any of us off.
No.
All good stuff, eh? All being well, our guest speaker for next Saturday, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, will be Dr. Ogo Osamor. Lots to cover, but if you remember, last Sunday, the 29th of March, the clocks march forward by 1 hour, marking the start of British summertime, but also affecting our circadian rhythm. Yeah, so what's your circadian rhythm then? Well, it makes sure all of the processes that go on inside your body run optimally throughout a 24-hour period. Ideally, it tells you when to wake up by making you feel more alert in the early morning, and when to go to sleep by promoting tiredness in the evening. It also affects other important systems like your hormones, digestion and immune system. Modern lifestyles can be tricky, make it tricky to sync up with our natural rhythm. So on the right of this article were some tips on or how you could improve your habits and improve your circadian rhythm. But obviously the clock's changing does affect you, and it takes a bit of time to adjust to that. But this article, I forgot where I got it from. Some magazine, might have been Tesco indeed. This article talks about finding your circadian rhythm. And it says basically, create a consistent sleep schedule. Good sleep habits can help regulate your circadian rhythm. So aim to go to bed at the same time every night and wake up at the same time each morning, even on weekends. More difficult than that sounds for some. Also, it says take an early morning walk. Exposure to natural light first thing in the morning can help reset your circadian rhythm, sending signals to your brain to wake you up and make you feel more alert. The article also says limit screen time in the evening. Avoid using your phone or watching TV an hour before bed. The blue light that screens emit can interfere with your body clock by suppressing the sleep hormone melatonin. Also says get regular exercise. It says even 10 minutes of exercise a day can improve sleep quality. Just avoid too much physical activity close to bedtime, as this may make it harder to fall asleep. Also, watch your coffee intake. Caffeine is a stimulant that can interfere with sleep, so avoid drinking caffeinated beverages close to bedtime. Drinking lots of alcohol can also disrupt your sleep. Try reading or taking a bath before bed to help you relax. So there you are, sorting out your circadian rhythm. Boomtown Rats there with Clockwork, because we were talking about circadian rhythm. What a great track. 1978.
That was off our Adams vinyl.
It was indeed. Well, you are listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. In the science news this week.
Yes, cheetahs, giant otters and great hammerhead sharks are among dozens of species that countries have agreed to save by imposing stronger protections. Last Sunday, 29th of March, more than 130 countries, including Britain, concluded a global conference on migratory species by passing 40 new protections for birds, whales and other species that travel huge distances and cross borders. Elsewhere in news, an extremely rare fungus never before recorded in the UK has been found at a nature reserve in West Sussex. The blue-based earth tongue was stumbled upon by a fungi enthusiast at Kingly Vale National Nature Reserve and identified with help from the British Mycological Society.
The mushrooms, eh? We were talking about mycelial leather as well the other week. It's all about the mushrooms. Anyway, meanwhile, a fragment of jawbone found deep underground in a cave in Somerset has rewritten the story of when and how dogs became our best friends. DNA analysis shows the jaw belonged to one of the earliest known domesticated dogs and that people lived closely with them in Britain 15,000 years ago, which is thousands of years before farm animals were domesticated or cats padded into our homes. The discovery pushes back the time that the dogs first evolved from their wolf ancestors by around 5,000 years. It also suggests that the friendship between the very first dogs and Stone Age humans was there from almost from the very start, and that's according to Dr. William Marsh of the Natural History Museum. The first dogs were descendants of grey wolves that lingered around human camps at the end of the Ice Age, scavenging leftovers and slowly becoming tamer. Over time, people started using these animals to help with hunting, guarding and tracking, turning them into working partners rather than wild predators. And finally, an interesting one, the UK set a new record for wind generation last week, producing 23 gigawatts of electricity on the 25th of March.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see the answer, my friend?
What a great track there, by Bob Dylan, of course, Blowing in the Wind, from 1963. We played that because the UK set a new record for wind generation last week, producing 23 gigawatts of electricity on the 25th of March. Of course, you listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. What's wrong with you this morning, Julie? I think it's because it's a bank holiday. I think I should still be asleep. But anyway, we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
Yeah, we're still here. We're still working, aren't we, Paul? Eh?
Well, yes, and other people are as well. So I'll just give you a fair warning that they're doing some track laying for the tram.
Are they indeed? Outside. Oh, just so, what you want on your bank holiday weekend, that, Paul?
Yes, we've had a couple of days and long nights.
Oh,
so far.
Blimey. I must say that it was very quiet on the streets this morning when we cycled in. I think it's because everybody's in bed, or possibly the fuel situation. Who knows?
Yes, it could be.
I know. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, I thought something timely. I had a quick look at why we talk about the Easter Bunny. And I know that rabbits have been involved, I think they're introduced to British Isles by the Normans after the Norman conquest. And that's because they used to farm rabbits because they were quick to breed and reproduce. So they were an arduous source of meat at difficult times of the year. But why the Easter Bunny occurs, and again, there's a strange crossover. It looks like the sort of more recent origin of the Easter Bunny could be traced back to a German sort of dalliance at this time with the Easter hare, was what they had. And the Easter hare used to come along at the beginning of the season in spring and decide which children had been good and which had been bad, and they got a gift. And that's sort of evolved nowadays to generally be chocolate eggs or chocolate rabbits are a great thing. But we also have lots of side alleys about it. But been around since, I think, the Eocene period, so 50, 60 million years ago. And sort of against the nice sort of idea of rabbit, they were classified as rodents up until about 1912, and then they were reclassified, and they sort of share a genre with things like pikas, little rabbit-like things that scurry around on rock faces in different places around the world. But that's the Easter Bunny, and we of course now have the Easter Egg, and they both stem originally from sort of pagan beliefs about rebirth and the idea that eggs are a new life, and that's how the Easter eggs and bunnies got involved, and we see them around today. So scientifically, there's a bit of news out, and that's perhaps good news to the people who are tucking into their chocolate Easter eggs. And that scientists say that the body mass index has been getting it wrong for about a third of adults. So it's one of those things that came about when anybody was looking for diets and to see if they fitted the norm. Well, they created this scale, the body mass index, and you get a green light if you were normal in the range. You get a yellow warning light if you were slightly over, and if you became obese, you turned into an orange, and then
not literally, Paul.
No. Then extremely obese, you got a red light warning. So it was one of those things that were meant to simplify for people really whether they were doing it too brown, you know, if we're in the chocolate season. And it's a new study that's suggested that this widely used health metric may have been getting it wrong for a large proportion of the population. And comparing BMI classifications with precise body fat measurements using advanced DXA scans, researchers have found that more than a third of adults were placed in the wrong weight categories. So many people labelled as overweight or obese did not actually have corresponding body fat levels, while others were missed entirely. So it's research in Italy that looks at the widely used index, and the classifications it's using where they may be wrong. So the findings are going to be presented at the European Congress on Obesity, which is due May the 12th to 15th, I think, in Istanbul in Turkey. And it's also published in the magazine Nutrients. And that shows when body fat's measured using a dual energy X-ray, which is the absorbitometry, that's the DXA, and considering the gold standard method, BMI is often incorrectly labelling individuals as obese or overweight. So sort of good news for us, I think, that maybe we're not all in such a state.
Well, I remember doing that at work. Somebody brought something in and did it. And women have a higher fat rate anyway, but just because of the way we're built.
They do, yeah.
We have bits and pieces that men don't have in some cases. Yeah. But, and I was like, how can that be? And then, it's different for men and women, isn't it? So I wondered if you were going to say it was women that were more overestimated.
It's just the standard that you measure by. And I say it was meant to be an easy standard, but in actual fact, it wasn't correct for a significant proportion of people who would have been measured by it. So I think it is one of those things, evolutionary. I think women are built for longer-term survival than men. So that used to be one of the things that you could guarantee, is that ladies would extend by a few years the lifespan, whereas we poor blokes used to drop by the wayside.
I think historically that was to do with just working conditions and things like that. You know, when men worked in, you know, manual labouring jobs more than anything.
Well, it is, but I think there's some basic evolution in it as well. I think that men being tasked with some of the heavier things because of strength, maybe wore out a bit quicker. But, say the interesting thing that is ladies would store fat in different parts of their body, and that dictated to some extent body shapes. And you sort of see the forms of female representation way back, and you see it's the kind of more matronly, they call it, I think, figure.
Carry on, matron.
Yeah. That was very tactfully put, Paul.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think we men could be categorised as well, you know, weaklings and beefy guys and all that sort of thing. And it's just how you measure and what the yardstick is. So that was really the thing that caught my eye, is that body mass index probably wasn't the correct gauge to be using. And I think that also then, so looking at improvements that are coming from DNA developments, and a surprising one that caught my eye came from the Karolinska Institute, and they've come up with a new gene therapy that's giving people who are born deaf the chance to hear. And it's often, once this treatment's applied, they will develop hearing within just weeks.
Wow.
There's a small but groundbreaking study. Researchers delivered a working copy of a key hearing gene directly into the inner ear using a single injection. And in a 10-patient sort of group, ranging from young children to adults, they experienced improved hearing, with some showing rapid gains in just 1 month.
Wow.
So, again, sort of looking into DNA, it says gene therapy can significantly improve the hearing in people born with congenital deafness or severe hearing loss. And, again, that's one of the things that a lot of people are worried about. And even it's appeared in Peppa Pig's family, where little George has been diagnosed with a bit of hearing loss.
Do you watch Peppa Pig, Paul?
Oh, well, obviously, yeah. I mean, you've got to keep in touch with the real world.
Well,
this is
maybe
the real
better,
world.
Maybe better watching Peppa Pig than the news, perhaps,
yeah,
sometimes.
Well, yes, I suppose it's a better kind of pig that can watch. But, little George got fitted with a hearing aid.
So that's
helping him hear properly. And putting him in touch with his family a bit better than he was before. So maybe this is a treatment for people for the future.
Wow, because a lot of people we know have got hearing aids. Generally, they don't wear them.
Yeah.
Or they've turned off.
Or they turned off, or they left them at home, or...
Well, there is, a sort of age-related hearing loss where... when you're young, your hearing probably fits into the hi-fi range of sort of 50 hertz-ish through to 20 kilohertz. So that sort of range. As you get older, that top end range will slowly decay past 15, which is the sort of sub-hi-fi norm, not super hi-fi. And then it'll drop beyond that. So if you want a yardstick for that, when they designed telephones, when they used to have a handset and be connected by a wire, their range was up to 3,500 or 3.5 kilohertz. So you could decipher what somebody was saying quite readily using just that low end of the range, and a lot of things for people who were involved in music and other areas took that range higher. And I think that it's one of those things, if you can track that hearing loss, then you can start to break down the isolation for people
with
deafness and lots of other things that have been happening with DNA. And one of the things that they found with DNA is that the double helix standard is getting further and further researched and known. Some of the finding is that there's actually movement within the helix. So although it looks like it's sequential strands, there is some movement within that which can change some of the properties. So there's a lot of research now going into the sort of background to DNA. And again, some of the treatments that are arriving from that are quite, you know, surprising. We've had the thing where there's a DNA supplement to help vision. So people are losing vision. The various things are being studied in depth and treated by variations of sorting the DNA, or gene splicing is one of the things that we've talked about, where you can take one of these key sectors out of the DNA and insert it back into the DNA of people who are alive but are suffering from some of these various sort of changes. And again, I think on that front, and some research has been done to say about COVID, and scientists have looked into why. Guess what? We're having a delivery as well.
Oh, I thought that was the cat.
Ding dong.
Yep.
Is it Avon, dear. Paul?
Yeah, not quite. No, I don't. I'm not that good looking. Thank you.
Is that Easter eggs then, Paul?
Yeah. Okay.
We love live radio, but this is what makes it, Paul.
Yeah. This is the modern world. Yes, sorry about that.
So you were saying about some new research about COVID.
Yes, yeah, that older lungs are one of the reasons why adults are hit harder. And this is a study in the University of California. And the study reveals aging lungs may play a major role in why flu and COVID can become so dangerous for older adults, and they found that certain lung cells can trigger an exaggerated immune response, and that creates clusters of inflammatory cells that end up damaging lung tissue instead of protecting it. So again, possibility is that they can identify this and treat that at a sort of DNA level. Older adults are far more likely to develop severe illness from flu or COVID, which is still rolling along and still sort of changing into new variations. And this new research from the University of San Francisco offers an explanation. And then once you see that and see that it can trigger this big aggressive immune response, then you can actually look to protect people with some of the findings that are coming from DNA. So that's all very interesting, I think, is sort of the background to that kind of research. And really sort of looking about the things, there's some research that says that gene mutation may trap the brain in a wrong reality for schizophrenia patients.
Oh, interesting.
So schizophrenia-linked gene mutation may lock the brain into an outdated belief, but scientists just found a way to flip the switch back. So again, looking at it, newly identified gene mutation may help explain why schizophrenia patients struggle to update their understanding of reality. And the mutation disrupts the brain circuit involved in flexible decision making, and that's causing mice to stick to outdated choices even when conditions change. So researchers have pinpointed the issue as a key thalamus prefrontal cortex pathway, And by reactivating this circuit, they were able to restore normal behaviour, raising hope of, again, future therapies.
Wow.
So it really is a sort of broad front attack on a lot of issues that are facing human beings. And it's coming out from that initial fundamental work of identifying the DNA, and now actually being able to look in detail at the components that are within your DNA and the areas that they deal with, and possibly using that in many ways to change outcomes for people who've got real diseases.
And yeah, brilliant stuff, Paul. And you've chosen a great track as well.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, it's one of those things, everything changes, and this is a great track from David Bowie.
It is indeed. Great stuff, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
All being well,
thank
we'll speak
you.
To you Monday, Easter Monday, for Glorious Rock Show 1 till 3.
I'll try and get my deliveries all collected.
All right, Paul, bye-bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Now may change me. Sides, but never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't tell them to grow up out of it.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Where's your shame? You've left us up to her neck.
Great song there from David Bowie, of course, Changes, because our PG was talking about latest research into DNA. All good stuff here. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital at Fiend South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil.
You have got Phil Muffett on the line.
We've got you on the line. You're under the stairs again, aren't you? Admit it.
I'm in the office.
You're living like Harry Potter, under the stairs. They never let you out, do they? I'm amazed you're not a Manvers, actually.
Well, yes. Yeah, usually I am. But anyway, I'm working today.
You're working. You've got chores to do.
It's
on
that
your
time of year.
It is Easter bank holiday chores. I've told Paul he's got a paint shed when he gets home.
It's a good reason to stop.
So, Phil, for people who don't know, and how could that be possible? You are a member of the Ben Swinton Astronomical Society.
Thank you.
Going for strength to strength, if you ask me. So today you're going to talk first about club news, aren't you? And then you're going to do Eye on the Sky, and then we might even talk about the Artemis launch.
I'm sure I have a bit of time left.
Yes, excellent. So nice. Come on, what's going off in your club? Because you've had loads of speakers, I note.
Yes, we've got quite a few speakers. Got a nice full programme. Next week, the talk is the goddess of the dawn sky, which is Aurora. So that should be an interesting talk. We've seen a couple of them now, so that's going to be okay. 16th of April, practical solar observing. It's coming to that time of the year where it's shorter nights and it's hopefully sunnier weather.
Yesterday, I was convinced Good Friday, I saw the forecast was good. It wasn't.
The weather this year has been absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when you do that, you've got to just hope for the best, haven't you?
Yeah, it is. I hate to think what we've missed this year in the sky, because I've not got much photography in, but when it has been clear, I have been out there and I've been doing stuff, and I've managed to get some quite nice pics with my telescope and camera gear that I'm still developing and improving on. It's a never-ending story. We'll be talking about it for years.
We will.
To giant leaps, and it's about mission to Mars.
Oh, you're breaking up a bit, Phil. I know you're upstairs.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better. So I don't know what you're doing, but...
oh, sorry. Then on the 30th, we've got the Royal Observatory Edinburgh.
Oh!
What are they doing? It's past, present and future.
Amazing.
As we move into May, we've got electron exoplanets, and on the 14th of May, we've got observing from the Azimuth telescope. So we do have a very, very varied programme.
How do they find out about you, or do you approach them then?
Well, we have a very good speaker finder called Roy Gunson, and he does a lot of, I'm assuming, internet searching. He's got a foot in a few people's doors, and one of the things is, once you've kind of got in, you tend to get recommendations for other people, and also he's kind of got a list of people he gets down as well. So, yeah, the other thing to consider is a lot of these people that are doing science also have to get the CPD in.
Yeah.
Continual
professional development.
So it's an easy hour for somebody to donate online.
And to talk about something they love anyway.
Exactly. And they don't have to leave their office or leave. Because most of our guest speakers, 90% of our guest speakers are online. And to be honest, it's really good to get some of these professors and doctors talking to us about what they do, how they do stuff. It's amazing. And we have it all in our room.
Well, it's good for them, and it's good for you as a club. And they're talking to people. They're preaching to the converted, aren't they? They're actually telling you more about things that they're emerging, aren't they?
And this is one of the good things about being in a club. It's the fact that you're at the cutting edge of what's happening. Whereas if you buy, like, telescope magazines, it's all well and good, nice articles, but it's what's already happened. And this is, like, up-to-date cutting technology and what they're doing at this time. And you also find out secrets that people are doing that you don't write about. So it's really good.
Well, you learn. It is a social thing. Gareth Morgan, who's Sheffield Photographic Society, he was talking about the benefits of being in a club. And it's what you learn from each other, but it's a social thing as well.
It is. And to be honest, we only had a meeting the other day about membership and driving to get some more members and getting new people into the club. And it's a sorry state of affairs in the UK. Less and less people are joining clubs.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People are going online rather than joining clubs. Now, online stuff's great, but you don't get that social interaction. And you can't ask them questions to people unless you're online with them or in a group. And plus the fact it gets you into... I mean, we've been to Oxford University, had a tour around the university. I've been in Jodrell Bank behind the scenes. We've been into Cambridge University.
Ooh.
We've been in to see the observatory and the telescopes, touch stuff. And it's like you can get places you can't get as a member of the public. So it does have its benefits.
Yeah. And what Gareth Morgan was saying, in his club, it's an opportunity. If somebody's got a different camera or bit of equipment or new equipment, because often it's very expensive like it is in your field of stuff, but you can get to try it out or you can get advice before you take the plunge yourself.
You certainly can. Well, I've got an Astro camera on loan from Tony Morris, who's our curator. And he's a photographer as well, and I've got one of his cameras on loan.
Ooh.
And I'm going to end up buying one. Don't ask me how many hundreds of pounds.
Oh my God! You're gonna have to flog some it. You know, why don't you flog what you were building?
It might be a birthday present. You never know.
Oh yeah, save all your birthday presents. But it's a great thing because you're not taking the risk, are you, of buying something and then thinking, "Hang on, this isn't quite what I want."
That's true, and it's easy to buy the wrong gear as well.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, people can kind of bring you on. And the other thing is being in a club, and we've been doing this just recently. Last week, one of our newer members hasn't got a telescope, and we've got some spare ones in the observatory, and we've got an 18-inch mirror that somebody's got the club, and we had it out in the observatory last Friday, I think it was, after the PBE. And we were looking at the moon through an 18 Alex Mead, and it was absolutely cracking. It's been used for years.
Oh, wow.
And it like blew us away. We got some good eyepieces and had a look at the moon and Jupiter, and it was a cracking image. And anyway, he's going to get that on loan from the club.
Brilliant. So, it's better than it being sat there doing nothing.
So he's going to get used to a telescope that he's had to buy.
Brilliant. So you'd had a public viewing evening then?
Yeah, we did. We had the last one last Friday up at the observatory. So now it's starting to get lighter. Well, we had the equinox back on the 20th of March. So day and night is equal.
Yes.
So kind of the sun went through the equator so that it's now more daylight than night time. And, of course, the constellations are moving around in the sky. Orion's nearly disappeared into the evening light, and we're kind of coming round into the spring constellations like Leo and Virgo. Gemini's still up with Jupiter, so Jupiter's still a cracking object to look at. It's one of the really bright objects due south, southwest. Really worth looking at. It's nice and big, and I think this weekend the red spot is on show. It should be right. More or less in the middle of Jupiter, so it should be relatively easy.
And could you see that with a naked eye then, or do you need binoculars?
See Jupiter with a naked eye. To get a disc out of Jupiter, you need a pair of binoculars. But if you've got a telescope, you'll be able to see the bands on Jupiter, and you should be able to see the red spot. You'll see the moons.
If it's a clear sky.
If it's a clear sky, yeah. I noticed it cleared up last night, and nearly got my gear out last night. But it was a bit breezy around Swinton.
Yes,
it was a bit nippy, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna watch a bit of TV. It was just a bit too cool for me last night.
So it was a final public viewing event at your observatory, Hoover.
Yeah.
Is that they start again? Autumn?
Oh, back in October, November, December.
Yeah. So did you have a good turnout again?
Yeah, we usually get we have up to 20 people to turn up. A person doesn't turn up on the day, but yeah, we get about 20 people.
Is it the same people or do you get different people?
Oh, well, we're pretty online and we always get different people come in.
Wow, that's brilliant.
There's a lot of we could do it much more, but the problem is it's like manning it.
It's time, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and it does take up your Saturdays.
You need to, like I say, you need to retire, Phil, but then you won't be able to afford all these new bits and pieces you need. Will you? But brilliant. So are you still doing your solar events
solar
in the summer?
In a month or two. So, while we're on about observing, there's also the Lyrids this month, which is on the 21st, 22nd of April. It's a meteor shower late at night. They are a bit faint and they're not as good as the Perseids, but there will be some shooting stars knocking about.
Oh.
And associated with that as well, we've also got a new comet that was discovered back in January this year called MAPS C/2026A1. So it was discovered down in Chile with one of the big telescopes, and it's been heading in towards the sun. It's just gone around the back of the sun, and it's called a sun grazer, which means it passed within 100,000 miles of the surface of the sun. So we don't think it's disintegrated, and it should be just popping around the back of the sun now. So it'll be coming out around the sun on the left-hand side. So just after sunset, it'll start rising in the sky underneath Venus. Now, if you've noticed, after sunset, there's a really, really bright object just above the sun after it goes down. That is a planet Venus, which is our closest neighbour.
Wow.
So that's getting higher in the sky, and there's a comet coming up underneath it. Now, they reckon it's going to have a bright, long tail, and it will be naked eye, so we'll be able to see it. However, I've heard this story many, many times, and quite often you can't see them, and you need to wait while the sun has actually gone down before you start looking for it. But you're looking about 8:30 for the next 2 weeks after sunset. There may be a comet to the left of where the sun has set, low to the horizon.
Ooh.
But the problem is, this time of the year, the ecliptic is starting to get a narrower angle, so the sun's kind of sliding into the horizon instead of going vertical down. So it kind of, the twilight lasts longer, so it's more and more difficult to see stuff after sunset close to the horizon because it's brighter. But if it's a really bright comet, we might be able to see a nucleus and a bit of a tail. So it's a good time to see comets when they come around the sun, because the tail is being blasted out into space and it's warmed up. But the problem is the backlight in the sky is really bright, so it could be tricky.
So will that ever get... Obviously, it's given a name because it's been spotted, and it's given 2026 whatever. Will they not name it eventually?
The project that discovered it is called MAPS. It's a mapping survey, so they've called it MAPS. And then it's got a C/2026A1. The A1 stands for, it's the first one of the year that discovered, because it was really the early part of the year. So all the letters and numbers mean something. It's just to catalogue them, and then they might give it a name
later on.
I can't remember the guy. There were three guys that were working on the project. So they might give it a
yeah, it's just it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? If they said it's called, well, I don't know.
Yeah, Phil. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Phil 1.
Yeah, it could. Yeah. So they sometimes do name after people that
find them. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's that many now they're discovering. They always have a code number. So then sometimes they give it a name afterwards.
If it turns out to be worthy of a name.
Yeah, they might get stick a name to it, yeah.
Brilliant. So, yeah. So what else are you looking forward to looking at then this spring?
Mercury, Mars, Saturn and Neptune are all really, really early morning objects just before the sun pops up, so I won't bother. Venus, they'll be hard to see anyway. Venus, Jupiter, Uranus are up after sunset, but Uranus is getting difficult to see. Jupiter's still good. Venus is going to be a showstopper over this next month. And if you can look at Venus with a telescope, you'll see it go through its phases like the moon does. So that should be okay to look at.
Now, somebody did a quiz for us recently, and it was about the order of the planets. So I'll just put a note to ask you that. How do you remember the order of the planets easily, like a mnemonic? Have you got a little saying?
I just know where they are. So Mercury is one of the smallest and closest. Then you've got Venus, which is our closest neighbour. It's very, very like Earth. Then there's us. Then you've got Mars. So we're the four inner terrestrial planets that have got a rocky surface. And then you get to Jupiter, which is the biggest one, which is a big gas giant. Then you've got Saturn, which is a slightly smaller planet, it's a gas giant, and it's got the rings around it. Then you've got Uranus, first telescopic planet to be discovered by William Herschel. And we've got Neptune, which was discovered by Mathematics, by John Couch Adams, And that was in the telescope in Cambridge when it was first seen. And I've actually seen that telescope and touched it, which was a telescope. And then, of course, Pluto was discovered by Clive Tombaugh. Was it back in in the 1920s? I can't remember the date. And that was the first one discovered telescopically using a blinkometer, where they compare photos together to see what objects have moved. So that's an easy way to remember. And of course, there's the asteroid belt in between Mars and Jupiter, where there should be a planet, but there isn't one.
Right. Because you talked about the asteroid belt, didn't you? So the sun, where's the sun in that then?
Well, the sun's at the centre.
It's right at the centre.
At the centre of the solar system, which is why it's called a solar system. It's a solar system.
Oh. Get you away. Eh?
And then around that, we've got all the minor planets and asteroids, and we've also got all the comets that are whizzing around as well.
Wow. I think I distracted your train of thought there. Sorry, Phil, when you were talking about what we could see in the star. It came up as a quiz question, and still were like, what's the fourth closest planet to us? And we're like, don't know.
Mars. We're third, then it's Mars. Yeah, you just go through me. But yeah, after 40 years, 50 years.
It's in there, yeah. Must try harder, Julie.
Yeah, and of course, the other big event is, you know what, the launch of SLS, Artemis.
Yeah.
To the moon. Is it 50 years? Is it 50 years since we've been to the moon?
Wow. Were saying, all of a sudden, they've been talking about this for years, and it all happened very quickly.
It all happened very quickly, and do we know who Artemis is?
Oh, do we?
Do you know who? A good quick quiz question?
No.
It was the twin sister of, guess who?
Hercules.
Apollo.
Apollo.
The twin sister of Apollo, which is why they've called it Artemis.
Clever. I will remember that. Easy.
It's a follow on from Apollo. Yes, it had me fooled for a while, and then the penny dropped when I realised who it was. So Artemis was the twin sister of Apollo, which is why I named it that.
Interesting.
The SLS stands for Space Launch System.
Wow.
That is the new rocket. Now then, the other month I complained about journalism being wrong. Well, I heard some other journalism that was wrong the other day as well. They said that the Artemis is the biggest rocket that NASA have ever built or has ever been built, and it's not actually true. So Apollo 5, the Saturn V rockets were actually taller than the Artemis rockets. I think what they should have said is the Artemis rocket is the most powerful rocket ever produced.
Yeah.
So it's actually about 6 meters shorter, but it's actually a lot more powerful. And one of the reasons for that is they've also got two solid rocket boosters strapped to the side of it, which is what they did with the space shuttle launchers, so they could get more power into it. They added boosters on. Well, when I looked at it on TV, it looked like they were using the same design boosters. So yeah, so that helped it get it off the ground, and of course it's up there in orbit, so it's on its way to the moon now. I think it's a 10-day mission to get to the moon. I think they're going to orbit the moon once or twice and then come back to Earth, and it's basically a recce to make sure everything works and they can actually get there and back safely. So the next mission, I believe they're actually going to try and land on the moon.
Oh.
So I don't know if that'll be next year or not, but anyway,
so
things have progressed.
They've been talking about this for a couple of years, and you were saying why is it being delayed for that amount of time then?
You can't afford an accident, basically.
No, indeed, because it must have cost a fortune to build it.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also people's lives involved in this as well. So, I think we've got four crew members, so you don't want to lose your crew. And the other thing is it'll set it back decades if they have an accident. So everything's got to be 100% functional, working.
Am I right in thinking they launched it on the 1st of April?
The 1st of April.
Why would you?
I must admit, I thought exactly.
Yeah, because you said they've been talking about it for 2 years, and all of a sudden they said we're launching it, and they must have made a decision that the conditions were right and we're ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's either things like the weather. If the weather's not right, I think the clouds cleared quite decently. They were going to launch it back in February. That got cancelled. Minor technical glitches. In fact, they had a few technical glitches on the day. And they had a two-hour window. And I think my son asked me, why have they got a two-hour launch window when they're going to the moon? Which is a good question. And I think part of the problem is when they power up a rocket, there's only a certain amount of shelf time in which they can actually launch it. Things like batteries die after a period of time. The propellant heats up, even though it's insulated in the spaceship, in the space rocket, it actually gets warmer. So bear in mind, it's got cooled hydrogen and cooled oxygen. They'll only be able to keep it cool for so long once it's tanked up. So if it'll warm up after 2 hours, they've got to then say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't launch now. Empty it out, we'll go again next week.
Is that because it'd explode, get too warm, something?
Yeah, well, it'll expand. Yeah. It'll expand. So as it's cool, it shrinks. As it gets warmer, it'll expand. So there'll be all kinds of technical reasons. So there's lots and lots of reasons why they'll now have a launch window. Usually, well, if you're going to launch the space station, you've got a launch window in which it's in the same orbit that you are going to fly into. And if you miss that window, it'll delay you for the following day.
Do you mean that about the way the Earth's spinning?
Yeah, because you've got the Earth spinning and you've got satellites in space. So you need to launch at the right time so you can get into an orbit to engage your target. But going to the moon, it's a lot more flexible, but then you've got more reliance on your actual spacecraft leaving the ground.
Wow.
So there's lots and lots of things that control what happens.
And am I right in thinking it has to be launched in a particular direction?
Yes, if you notice, when things launch, they're going in an easterly direction. That's so they're travelling into the spin of the Earth.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
You are gaining speed by the fact that the Earth is turning underneath you.
Wow.
So if you went west, you'd actually have to add a few thousand miles an hour onto your speed.
Yeah,
so,
to fight it.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why it's in Florida. When it flies out over the sea, if it lands or has to explode or aborts or whatever, it's going to land in the sea and not on Texas or Mexico or wherever.
So it's a bit like, you know, if you're a sailor, you wouldn't sail against the tide because you wouldn't go anywhere. If the tide's as strong as as fast as your boat can go, you stay there.
Yeah, if you've got the tide and the wind in the same direction, it helps.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Just don't go the wrong way. Amazing. So how long does it take for that to get to the moon then?
Well, it's about a three-day travel. About three-day travel there. But it depends how long the stop in orbit. I think they only orbited the Earth once. But they could orbit the Earth a couple of times before they go into translunar injection, which is they leave our orbit, they boost a couple of thousand kilometres an hour into the spacecraft. And it basically, once they've fired it off, it's going towards the moon. Now then, if anybody knows anything about Apollo 13, they can't just stop and turn around and come back. Once they've actually fired to go to the moon from Earth orbit, they've got to go there to come back. Because when they get to the moon, they'll go into orbit, and then the orbit of the moon will help them to come back.
Really? Yeah. Well, I didn't know this. Yeah. So they've got no choice.
Next time you watch Apollo 13, they do explain it in the film.
Wow.
We can't stop and turn back. We've got to go to the moon and come back.
Is that because they won't be propelled back?
Yeah. Well, you'd have to stop your spacecraft, turn it round, and then fire it back, which would be a lot of fuel. Now, bearing in mind, the spacecraft has enough fuel to get there and back without doing any detours.
Yeah. Well, don't you learn stuff on this show, Phil, eh? Wow. So what speed is that going then to get to the moon then?
I think it's something like 24,000 kilometres an hour, I think it is.
Wow.
I think in Earth orbit, you've got to be doing 18.5 miles an hour. You've got to be doing 18,500 miles an hour just to stop in orbit like the space station. Wow. So to leave orbit, you've got to be doing more than 18,500 miles an hour. I think they take it up to something like 24,000 miles an hour. And then it's off to the moon. And then when it gets to the moon, if they get into the right trajectory, the moon will capture it and slow it down.
Wow.
Into orbit. And then to leave the moon's orbit, they have to fire around the backside of the moon, and the moon swings it round, and then it flings it back towards Earth.
Fantastic.
And we've got to aim it in the right place.
We've got 5 seconds left, Phil. That's amazing. I've learnt so much. Thank you so much, and happy Easter, Phil. Bye.